Stop 1. Introduction to the Museum.
Welcome to this audio-described guide to UCL's Grant Museum of Zoology, which tells a story of the astonishing diversity of life on Earth. The museum explores how the collections and research at UCL have a huge impact on how we understand and learn from the natural world. This understanding is more important than ever, as human actions threaten both the species that share our planet and our own survival. There are 10 main stops. Directions, including 3 additional half stops, give the route through the museum. Just pause the audio between stops. The whole tour should take 30 minutes to listen to. The museum was established in 1828 by Robert Grant as a comparative anatomy teaching collection. It is now home to around 100,000 zoological specimens from every continent, every ocean, and every animal group. This tour describes a selection of specimens, including extinct animals, mammals, amphibians, birds, fish, invertebrates, and microscopic life. The collection is housed in an Edwardian building, and we enter at the corner of a large rectangular room with a floor of polished wood. There's a reception desk to the right. Tall windows let in daylight along 2 adjacent walls, and an upper gallery runs around all 4 sides. It's about 4 metres up, with a further 2 metres to the room's high ceiling. Bespoke, floor-to-ceiling display cases of wood and glass run around the outside walls. More modern freestanding display cases divide the space up into a number of smaller areas. The cases are busily full with skulls, skeletons, fluid-preserved specimens in glass jars, taxidermy, glass and wax animal models, fossils and pinned entomology. Many are displayed in front of a dark blue background. More skeletons look down at us over the ornate metal railings of the gallery, including a chimp, an orangutan and a gorilla. In the centre of the museum is a rectangular central space with modern light grey tables and chairs.
Our next stop is the case opposite the entrance. It's a modern display case about 3 metres square. Pause the audio until you're in front of it. Stop 2. Species on the move.
As humans move around the globe, they take animals with them. Sometimes this is accidental, sometimes deliberate, but it can have disastrous consequences. In the centre of this case, on the top 2 shelves, are various examples of invasive species. Perhaps the most startling is at the top, a domestic cat preserved in fluid within a rectangular jar. The cat appears to be running towards the left, although its legs seem unnaturally limp, and on closer inspection, we realise there are only 2. This is because this is a dissected specimen, although the dissected side of the cat is turned away from us. The view we have is of its gingery fur and a curved back and downturned tail. Its head is to the left and pressed up against the glass, with its little tongue sticking out, pink colour now bleached out. Domestic cats kill hundreds of millions of small animals every day. Humans introduced cats to places they would not naturally live, endangering wildlife and causing the extinction of many species. On the next shelf down, at about chest height, there are 3 exhibits. Running along the back, a rectangular glass case about 60 centimetres wide contains a forest of rabbit leg bones. There are over 100 complete legs, all arranged vertically with their digits and sharp claws uppermost, creating the spiky branches. They vary in colour from cream to honey, and arranged in this way have the quality of an art installation. English settlers in Australia introduced familiar animals like rabbits to add a touch of home. Rabbits do huge damage to the environment, eating native plants to extinction and destroying the habitats of Australian animals. To the right and in front of the rabbit legs, a small taxidermied starling perches on a branch. It has bluey black feathers with orangey brown flecks on its back, a small sleek head and sharp pale yellow beak. Since their deliberate introduction, European starlings have become one of the commonest birds in the US. They cause $1 billion of crop damage every year and outcompete native species for food and nest sites. To the left of the rabbit legs, a cane toad is preserved in a cylindrical glass jar about 12 centimetres wide. The toad sits on the bottom of the jar. It has a straight, sloping back which joins its powerful, squatting rear legs. It has a wide, flat head with eyes that bulge out at the top. The toad's fawn-coloured skin is gnarled and knobbled, and the whole thing is distorted and magnified behind the curved glass. Cane toads are somewhat ironically named, having been taken to Australia to eat pests on sugarcane, but preferring instead to eat local wildlife. Their numbers exploded. They are poisonous too, threatening endangered predators like quolls, small marsupials native to Australia.
Just to the left of this display case, on an eye-level glass shelf against the museum wall, are two tiny frogs in very small cylindrical jars. These indicate our next stop. The focus of the exhibit, though, is not the physical frogs, but rather sound recordings of them in their habitat, highlighting how the museum's collection is being used in cutting-edge research. Stop 3. Bioacoustics.
So glossid frogs are only found on the islands of Mahé, Silhouette and Praline in the Seychelles. The two displayed here are side by side in separate jars. The one to the left is about 1.5 centimetres long, with a brown speckled back. The one to the right, much smaller and paler. The frogs grow up to 2 centimetres and live in leaf litter on the forest floor, making them hard to spot in the wild. For this reason, UCL researchers are monitoring these tiny frogs using bioacoustics, recording and studying the frog's sounds at different elevations on the islands. We'll let Dr. Jim Labisco tell us more about the work.
My name is Dr. Jim Labisco, and I'm a lecturer in biodiversity based in UCL's Centre for Biodiversity and Environment Research. I'm interested in evolutionary change and adaptation in amphibians and work extensively on a relatively unknown but highly significant group of frogs called zooglossids, which are found on just 3 islands in the Seychelles archipelago in the Western Indian Ocean. One of the tools I use to study these frogs is bioacoustics. Along with a host of Seychelles colleagues across multiple islands and sites, we've been recording a few minutes of every hour, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to detect frog calls. Doing this helps us to understand their activity in relation to environmental conditions such as temperature and rainfall, and informs how we might protect not just the frogs, but all Seychelles' endemic flora and fauna, especially in light of climate change.
Understanding the differences in behaviour at different elevations gives insight into how the species is responding to climate change as the higher up the mountain, the cooler the temperature becomes. The researchers highlighted the frogs can adapt to changes in climate when they're gradual. This makes the current, rapidly warming climate a major threat to the species. The following audio clip was recorded high in the mist forests on Silhouette Island in the early morning. Dr. Labisco describes the sound the frogs make as being a bit like nails being run along a comb, followed by a series of clicks.
We now move on to our next stop. Turning so that the invasive species display case is on our left, we walk ahead a couple of metres. To the right, on a white knee-high platform, is a giant pair of antlers. Stop when you're there. Stop 3A, giant antlers.
These impressive dark brown antlers arc up either side of the skull, then splay out to form wide plates, with 8 tines or prongs radiating from them. These curve backwards, designed to lock in combat rather than to mortally wound a rival. Also known as the Irish elk, these extinct animals lived between 400,000 and 7,000 years ago. Standing at about 2 metres tall, their antlers could be twice as wide. This set measures over 2 metres across.
We continue another couple of metres past the antlers to the next display case on our left. It's made of polished wood and around 4 metres wide. It's divided into 4 vertical sections, and our next exhibits are behind the 3rd glass door. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 4. Extinction.
This case focuses on stories of extinction. To the left are fossilised remains from long extinct creatures like woolly mammoths, sabre-toothed cats and mastodons. Mastodons were very distantly related to mammoths and elephants. We're going to concentrate on an animal whose extinction was human-driven. Its skeleton stands on an eye-level glass shelf behind the third of the case's four doors. Although it resembles a dog, this is a thylacine. Also known as Tasmanian tigers or Tasmanian wolves, thylacines were actually marsupials and more closely related to kangaroos than to dogs or cats. The Greek word thylakos, meaning pouch. Standing on four long legs with raised heels, the thylacine skeleton faces to the right and reaches a height of about half a metre. It has a curved back with a delicate ribcage, a slim hip bone and long pointed tail which curves down towards its hind legs. The skull also shows similarities to the dog family with a long snout, a powerful jaw and sharp teeth, including curved canines at the front. Thylacines were carnivores, native to Australia and New Guinea, but by the time Robert Grant purchased this skeleton, they were only found in Tasmania. It is one of the original specimens owned by Robert Grant that he used in teaching from 1828 at UCL. Animals like the thylacine highlight issues of human-driven extinction, habitat loss and colonisation. British colonists in Tasmania hunted thylacines incorrectly believing they were a threat to sheep. From 1830 to 1909, hunters were paid a bounty for killing them. The last recorded thylacine died in a zoo in Hobart, Tasmania in 1936, 2 months after the species was given legal protection. On the shelf below the skeleton is a large cylindrical jar containing a fluid-preserved thylacine, which reveals the gingery-striped fur that covered the animal's lower back and gave rise to its Tasmanian tiger name. Genetic research on specimens like this extremely rare preserved thylacine can tell us a lot about extinct species. Some researchers plan to clone thylacines to bring them back, but should we spend time and money on this when so many other species are on the brink of extinction? To the right of the display case is a taxidermied orangutan. Orangutans are not extinct but critically endangered. Preserved whole, this orangutan stands almost a metre tall. He faces us with reddish-brown shaggy fur and a brown face. His long, powerful arms almost reach down to the plinth on which he stands. Found only on the islands of Borneo and Sumatra, all three species of orangutan are protected by law, but their habitat is being rapidly destroyed for timber and palm oil.
Turning so that the orangutan is on our left, we move forward into the central rectangular space. This is defined by freestanding display cases, which create an outer corridor around three of its sides. Tables and chairs in the centre of the space may be in many configurations and may even be occupied by students studying specimens from the collection. As you enter this lighter space, turn sharp left. We walk for about 4 metres past the skeleton of an Indian rhinoceros, which stands on a step-high plinth to the left. The display case facing us in the corner is our next stop. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 5. Elephants and rhino.
Elephants and rhinos are not closely related, but face similar threats from habitat loss, habitat fragmentation and poaching. This modern display case contains a number of skulls of infant and fully grown animals, along with other specimens. They are arranged in three columns. At the top of the case, to the left, is the skull of a Javan rhino, one of the rarest animals in the world with fewer than 80 still living. Because they're solitary and secretive, they're difficult to study. It's also one of the smallest species of rhino, the skull measuring around 40 centimetres from front to back. The age-browned skull faces to the left. It has a long lower jaw with a row of large molars. The upper jaw has a toothed section at the back, but the front lifts up and curves over, ending in a point. This raised part would have supported the single horn, with the open space beneath housing the creature's snout. Directly beneath, on a shelf at eye level, is an elephant's molar tooth. Crescent-shaped like a curved horn, this single tooth is almost as long as the rhino skull above. Its surface is etched by a series of deep ridges, designed to grind up to 160 kilograms of plants per day. Elephants have the biggest teeth in the world and wear through 6 sets of molars in their lifetimes. The centre of the case, an old-fashioned glass display dome around 60 centimetres high and half as wide, is almost filled with an elephant's heart. This real heart has been dried, varnished and painted for study, with blue and red paint highlighting the veins and arteries. Thin paper arrows protrude from the cut-off arteries at the top, labelling the different parts. An elephant heart weighs between 20 and 30 kilograms and beats about 30 times a minute. To the right of the case are two adult elephant skulls, one displayed above the other. The upper one belongs to an African forest elephant, the smallest of the three living elephant species. Its domed head measures around 80 centimetres high and 40 wide. It has a wide hole in the centre, like two circles joined together, which resemble large eye sockets, but are actually where the trunk would have been. The main part of the skull is made up of air cavities with a honeycomb design. This reduces the weight of the skull without affecting its structural integrity. The lower part of the skull is elongated as it splits and flares out to each side, providing the sockets for the elephant's tusks. Visible between them, and resembling the front of a shallow boat, is the elephant's lower jaw. It has a pointed, spike-like tip. The Asian elephant skull beneath is about twice as big. Whereas the African elephant has a rounded skull, the Asian elephant skull is twin-domed with a pronounced ridge down the centre. Two curved tusks are displayed at the bottom left of the case, their pointed ends to the left. Tusks are actually teeth, elongated, continuously growing in sizes that protrude well beyond the elephant's mouth. Their surface is yellow with age and polished to a sheen. In the 1900s, the British colonial government in India saw elephants as a resource to be managed for their labour and ivory. At the height of the ivory trade in 1870, nearly 200 tons were sold every year. These tusks belong to the museum's largest elephant skull. Elephants have rich social lives and live in large family groups led by adult females. They experience emotions such as love, anger, compassion, and grief. By bringing down trees, digging water holes, and spreading their dung, elephants make important changes to the landscape, creating habitats for other animals and plants and increasing biodiversity. Planning land use to give elephants access to water and migration routes, as well as using natural repellents like beehives, can reduce human-elephant conflict, protecting both species.
To the right of the case, a wide opening leads to the outer corridor. But before we go through, we're going to stop just the other side of the opening, where four tall, silver-framed glass cases are attached side by side to the central space wall. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 5A, Wall of Mice.
Welcome to the Wall of Mice. Four tall, vertical glass cases are mounted side by side like a set of doors. They each measure about 1 metre across and 2 metres high. Inside each case are 25 columns made up of small cylindrical glass vials with cork stoppers stacked top to bottom. There are about 36 jars in each column. Many have labels stuck on the outside. Others have a reference number on a strip inside. The regularity of the arrangement of cork and glass with the slight variations made by the labels create from a distance a pleasingly abstract work of contemporary art. It's only when we get closer we find what's inside. Each jar contains the tiny bones of a mouse. The wall of 4,000 mice represents only half the museum's collection of mice skeletons, each housed in a separate glass vial. Why the museum has so many specimens of the same animal may seem like a mystery, but they were all collected by UCL biologist R.J. Berry in the 1960s and 1970s for a research project. Each column in the wall houses mice from a different island around the world and enabled Berry to investigate the founder effect, which is the reduction of genetic diversity in isolated populations of a species. Mice were the perfect species to study, as they are found all over the planet due to humans inadvertently transporting them as stowaways. Not only have these mice helped to increase our understanding of the evolution of island populations, thanks to Berry's research, but they are still being used in modern research and DNA analysis today.
We're now going to go through the opening to the left of the wall of mice and into the outer corridor. Once through, turn right, and our next stop, the microarium, is almost immediately to the left. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 6. Microarium.
We step into this small alcove, the floor of which is only about 1 metre square. Three backlit walls rise to a height of about 2.5 metres with a mirrored ceiling above. The walls from about half a metre up are covered with small glass microscope slides, all brightly coloured and displayed vertically. Where many objects in the museum are impressively large, this is a space for tiny things. Different coloured dyes pick out the features of different species, many focused within a circle at the slide centre. The slides mostly show whole small animals or slices through them, the tiny legs and jointed abdomen of a snipe fly, the delicate veins of a tiny wing, the translucent body of a larva, the jointed squiggle of a flea tapeworm, stained in reds, pinks, purples and golden yellow. The sheer vastness of invertebrate diversity glows jewel-like with the backlight, like some kind of Aladdin's cave. A label asks why most museum displays are filled with big animals when 95% of animals are tiny. This microarium sheds light on our smallest animals, using some of the 20,000 microscope slides used by zoology students who could check them out like library books. The lower part of the walls show a selection of glass lantern slides, which were projected to illustrate lectures here at UCL. Some are photo reproductions, others annotated diagrams from textbooks, a dinosaur skeleton, butterfly wings, shells and corals, or the illustrated workings of a heart.
Turning with the microarium behind us, our next stop is the display case almost immediately opposite. This case contains a number of marine creatures, including sea anemones and coral. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 7. Sea anemones and corals.
On a chest-high shelf are some wax models of sea anemones. They were made by Maison Tramond, a 19th-century Parisian studio, and are displayed inside a glass dome. There are three different species. Two are quite similar, with thick, amorphous pedestals attached to a rock and disc-like tops, some 10 centimetres wide. These discs have rings of tendrils around the edge and a circular mouth at the centre. One is a grey-blue colour with long, slim tendrils. The other is a translucent, creamy yellow with three concentric rings of short, stubby tentacles and a more pronounced, puckered mouth. The third example is more graceful and lays down across the rock with a slender, yellow stem like a baby-ribbed squash. A purple collar near its tip sprouts long, blue, finger-like tendrils, which wave as though being wafted by water. The stinging tentacles around a sea anemone mouth are used to catch prey. They're closer related to corals, but solitary. On the lower shelf, close to floor level, are different types of coral. Coral reefs are some of the most diverse places on Earth. The reef structures are built by thousands of tiny individual coral animals, called polyps, that form colonies working together as if they were a single animal. Corals can take many forms, flat, rounded, branching or brain-like, creating entire ecosystems on which other organisms rely. And although corals might look like plants, they are carnivorous animals. To the left is an example of a soft coral or alcyonacea. It's pink, flat and fan-shaped and measures some 30 centimetres from top to bottom. It resembles a large leaf with a stem from which veins divide and subdivide. The main body of the coral has a delicate, lace-like structure. To the extreme right of the case is a hard coral or scleractinia, about 30 centimetres wide. Built of calcium carbonate, the coral has a rounded, rock-like form. Its cream-coloured surface is formed by a maze of squiggled lines, like crazily piped icing, between which is a delicately pierced, net-like structure. Coral reefs sustain 30% of all ocean species, and their degradation represents a stark reminder of the climate crisis. Their extreme complexity has made it difficult to understand how best to protect them, but modern technologies such as 3D mapping, acoustic monitoring and selective breeding are dramatically improving the prospects of successful reef conservation. Bioacoustics recordings of coral reef sounds such as these allow UCL researchers to hear reef health from the inside, track activity at night, and survey reefs in deep and murky waters. UCL scientists can then use AI to automatically process thousands of hours of audio to build new understanding of coral reef ecosystems.
With the corals to our right, continue along the outer corridor to the corner. We pass a number of high windows on our left, turn right at the corner, and continue for another 4 to 5 meters. We come to a tall glass case. It's on our left and built into the wall display. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 8. Sawfish rostra.
This feature display case, built into the museum wall, measures about 1 meter wide and 2 meters high, with the bottom of the case at waist height. It contains the narrow, flattened nose extensions of 7 sawfish, all displayed vertically, resembling double-sided saws. The rostra vary in width and length, but all have teeth in pairs, set at regular intervals along each side. Sawfish are cartilaginous fish, like sharks and rays. They feed on fish and crustaceans and use their rostrum to strike and pin down their prey. Not only are the rostra used to attack prey, they're also used to detect them. Lining the rostrum are pores called ampullae of Lorenzini. These detect weak electric fields generated by their prey and enable sawfish to hunt even in dark waters. Sawfish were once common. However, all 5 species of sawfish are now critically endangered and are among the most threatened groups of marine fish. These historic specimens were recently sampled as part of an international research project which analysed their DNA to compare it to DNA of live specimens. This will help determine the genetic health of living sawfish populations and aid conservation efforts.
With the sawfish rostra to our left, continue ahead to the corner and turn right. We pass down the 3rd outer corridor, with crammed display cases on either side. We pass an opening on our right after about 6 meters. Some 6 meters after that, there's a waist-high dark grey cabinet to the right on which a skeleton is on open display. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 8A, dugong skeleton.
This 2-meter-long skeleton belongs to a dugong, a marine mammal related to the manatee, with a cylindrical body that tapers at both ends. Its cylindrical ribcage takes up almost half its length, with paddle-like flippers attached to large shoulder blades close to the front. The skull has a sharply downturned snout and simple peg-like molars, specially adapted to graze on seagrass meadows across the Indo-Pacific. Its thick boned tail is mounted horizontally and about a metre long. 2 vestigial rods of bone just behind the ribcage are the evolutionary remnants of a pelvis, evidence that they evolved from an animal with hind legs.
With the dugong skeleton to your right, continue forwards. Our next stop, stop 9, is at the case which faces us at the end of this corridor. It's around 2.5 meters wide and 3 meters high. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 9, arthropods case.
Most animals are arthropods, invertebrates with a hard external skin or exoskeleton and jointed legs. This is the group containing insects, arachnids, crustaceans, centipedes, and millipedes. Because they have a hard exoskeleton, they must shed this skin to grow. When they do, a soft, folded new layer is revealed. This puffs out and hardens into a new, bigger exoskeleton. This display case teems with sea scorpions, spiders, crayfish, centipedes, trilobites, shrimps, crabs, other arthropods, and their relatives, including penis worms, the name referring to their appearance rather than their habitat. We're going to concentrate on a number of horseshoe crabs on an eye-level glass shelf to the left of the case. Horseshoe crabs are also named for their appearance, with the underside of their domed upper shell resembling a horseshoe. Attached beneath this is a tapering, almost triangular lower body shell and long, pointed tail, giving them the appearance of a round-topped kite. There are a number of examples in this display, the smallest measuring around 2 centimetres across. One much larger specimen at the back of the case in the centre is preserved in fluid in a rectangular glass jar. It measures around 20 centimetres from top to bottom and is around 15 centimetres wide. It's displayed with the underside towards us. Within its dark brown horseshoe dome are the top of 5 pairs of legs, though many in this specimen are missing. An opening in the centre of the legs is the crab's mouth. The lower, tapering part of the crab contains 5 pairs of flap-like appendages called book gills, which affect gas exchange within water. The long tail is missing from this example, but evident on a much smaller and paler specimen just in front and to the right. In 1881, these very specimens were used to prove that even though horseshoe crabs have 10 legs and a crab-like shell, they're more closely related to spiders and scorpions. The horseshoe crab's immune system is so sensitive to bacteria that its blood is used to test the safety of many medical treatments, including the COVID-19 vaccine. The crabs cannot be farmed, so they are caught when they come ashore to spawn and are now threatened by over-harvesting.
With the horseshoe crabs on your left, walk ahead a few paces back into the central space, turn sharp right and walk past the other side of the dugong skeleton. Just beyond it, to the right, is a glass display case with our final stop, the jar of moles. It's to the right of the case and about waist height. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 10. Jar of Moles.
This final stop is a Grant Museum favourite, a jar containing 18 adult European moles, Talpa europaea. They're quite tightly packed within a glass jar that resembles an old-fashioned sweet jar with a screw top. Their pink snouts and pointed, spade-like paws stand out against the writhing mass of dark, velvety brown fur. Moles do have eyes, but they are very small and can only see movement and the difference between light and dark. Instead, they feel and smell their way around their underground homes with touch-sensitive Eimer's organs on their nose and an excellent sense of smell. Quite why the museum has a whole jar of moles is something of a mystery, but this was probably an efficient way of storing specimens for a student dissection class or research project. This specimen has attracted much attention over the years and regularly receives posts from other museum mascots from around the world. The moles are also actively used in research. Recent projects have included the moles as a subject of a virtual reality experience, and forthcoming research will see the moles being used to test the identification capabilities of artificial intelligence.
This is the end of the audio described tour. We do hope you've enjoyed your visit. With the moles to your left, it's a fairly straight route back to the reception area. Walk past the dugong skeleton, then carry on past the orangutan to your right, and then past the giant antlers to your left and back to the reception desk.